This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last May, the Fox Network demonstrated the faith it had in one of its new fall prospects, a musical comedy series called Glee, by offering a sneak preview of it right after the final night of competition on American Idol. This week, Glee was launched officially as a fall series, so we're listening back to Terry's interview with the show's creator, Ryan Murphy. Ryan Murphy also created the WB teen comedy titled Popular and the darkly comic FX series Nip Tuck about two egocentric cosmetic surgeons. Murphy also directed the movie Running with Scissors. The series Glee is about a high school teacher who is trying to put together a winning high school Glee club with a group of students who are, for the most part, unpopular misfits and not particularly talented, with one or two key exceptions. The high school teacher, played by Matthew Morrison, also has to contend with challenges from the coach of the cheerleading squad, who sees the Glee Club as competition. In this scene, the cheerleading coach confronts him. She's played by Jane Lynch.
So I had a little chat with Principal Figgins, and he said that if your group doesn't place at regionals, he's cutting the program. Ouch.
You know, you don't have to worry about Glee Club. We're going to be fine.
Really? Because I was at the local library where I read Cheerleading Today Allowed to Blind Geriatrics. I came across this little page turner, show choir rule book. And turns out you need 12 kids to qualify for regionals. Last time I looked at you, only had 5.5. Here, cripple in the wheelchair. I also took the liberty of highlighting some special ed classes for you. Maybe you could find some recruits. Because I'm not sure there's anybody else who's going to want to swim over to your island of misfit toys.
Are you threatening me, Sue?
Threatening you? Oh, no, no, no. Presenting you with an opportunity to compromise yourself? You betcha.
Ryan Murphy, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the premise of the show is that there's a teacher trying to put together a really good show choir who can make it to the nationals and even win. Though he's working with this kind of like ragtag group. I'm not familiar with a show choir, and I assume that these exist, that you didn't just make it up for the series. But the show choir, it's like a choir, and it's a singing competition, but what they compete with is big like song and dance production numbers. It's not just, people in robes standing there singing.
No, I mean, it was an interesting thing that I had. When I was a kid, I was in choir, but it was, literally 16 of us in sad-looking tuxedos and acetate dresses,
right.
singing, Christmas songs. But the world has changed since then. And when we started writing this, we would go onto YouTube and we would look at these videos of these extravaganzas, and they are literally like Broadway-level shows. I mean, we were working with a choir during the pilot from Burbank who I think literally would spend $100,000 a year on costumes and sets and production value. So they had, I think, one woman who was a full-time sequin sewer. So we sort of tap into that a little bit. But on our show, our show was about underdogs, but we have the world's worst Glee Club. And I think the fun of the show to me is being able to sort of chart these kids who have nothing going for them but heart and, natural talent. And then over the course of the series, they will hopefully become national champions.
So while you were going onto YouTube to look at all these show choir production numbers, what were some of the most unlikely songs that you saw show choirs do?
I think it was very interesting about how moving it was to me. I was not expected to be so moved by it, but I think there's nothing more moving than kids singing and performing their hearts out, just because it seems like they're tapping into something so pure.
That's what I'll even go to like high school production number, high school musical sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's sweet. And, I remember being that age, and when you do perform and you are in high school, I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana, but I thought that I was on Broadway. You have this sort of weird misconception that the whole world is open to you, and maybe that's not a misconception, maybe it's the truth, but I pulled from that. That feeling is in the show. But to answer your question, the funniest thing I saw was a boy band tribute where they did like a medley of 15 boy band songs that I thought was pretty amazing. But they did it through the prism of Western wear, So they all wore cowboy outfits, and it was sort of this weird smash-up of elements that you kind of can't believe would work, but it did. And it worked because it was just so earnest. They believed in it so much, and that's what I loved about it.
So how did you go about, like, shopping for songs that you should use, and what were some of the more unlikely ones you decided on? I'll name one. I kissed a girl for the audition.
Right. The best part of my job is I pick all the songs, and people ask me how I do it, and it's just bizarre. I don't really know. Like, for instance, when we were doing the pilot, there was the sort of arch nemesis group, the world's best show choir that's competing against our little ragtag group of losers called Vocal Adrenaline, and they're sort of like, you know, the neo-Nazis of show choir that they train for 12 hours a day. And there really are groups like this, so it's not too much of a leap of faith. But I wanted them to do something that was sort of big and ironic. And then I was in my car and I was listening to the Amy Winehouse album Back to Black, and Rehab came on. And I thought, well, that's it, because I think it'd be funny for 16-year-olds to be singing about rehab and not really knowing what they're singing about, put through a prism of show choir. So that's how we did that. There are other songs that, you know, I just loved as a kid. Like, you know, we're working on a show where we do a big finale to the Queen song Somebody to Love. We're doing our version of Don't Stop Believin' by Journey. Also, the show was fun in that, you know, we try and pick songs where there's something for everybody. We have in almost every episode, we'll have a standard, we'll have a Broadway, we'll have a R&B, we'll have a top 40, we'll have a hip-hop, we're doing country and western, so we're trying to hit everything.
Now, one of the kids in the choir is, like, the real nerdy guy who plays a real, like, shredding guitar, but he's mm-hmm. he's in a wheelchair. So
yes.
How do you cast, like, the nerdy guy in the wheelchair? What were you looking for that character? And
I was just, for every character, you know, I mean, I think when you do a show like this, you need to do archetypes, but you also need to do things that are just original. And I wanted to do a character that from day one is in a wheelchair and remains in a wheelchair for the rest of the show. And the show is really about, you know, the show choir thing, I think, is a metaphor for being different and embracing your difference and being able to express yourself no matter how hard or how much pain you're in. So, for instance, for that character, we just read and read and read, and the actor we cast, his name is Kevin McHale. He actually was in a boy band and is in a boy band. And I think the name of their boy band is not, I think it's called Not Like Us. But he's hilarious, and we actually had to give him what we call a make-under because, you know, in his boy band stuff, he's in his tight little T-shirts and come-hither looks, and we sort of put him in these polyester horror show outfits. But that's how we cast that part. We just read and read. And, you know, the rule was the best performer wins for every role, and that's how we cast it.
Now, in the TV series Glee, there's a jock who, it turns out, sings really well, and he's kind of enlisted into the Glee Club. And he's accused by one of his fellow jocks of joining the homo explosion. Were you uh-huh. accused of being gay when you were in choir? And you are gay, so...
yeah.
What?
I had a very strange experience with that. I mean, I'm from Indiana, and which is a very conservative state. And I don't know what happened to me or by what grace of God I sort of was imbued with all this confidence. But I dealt with my sexuality at a very early age. I was 15, and I just sort of announced it, and I was that. And I guess because I was popular and I hung out with popular kids, you know, one of my best friends, and who is still one of my best friends, was the quarterback. I kind of was embraced. People didn't really understand me, but I projected a certain confidence, so they left me alone. I mean, certainly I got teased a little bit, but I had a very sort of wicked tongue, and I could go right back at them. So it didn't last very long. But looking back on it, I'm sort of moved by the fact that I didn't have a struggle. And I know so many people who did have a struggle and were terrified of dealing with it. And I dealt with it with my parents very early on, and they, of course, were not happy about it, and they, of course, took me to therapy. But I had a great therapist who, after two sessions, basically called my parents in and said, this is who your son is, and this is who he's always going to be, and you either have a choice to love him or accept him, or he will leave you, and it's your choice. And they sort of said, okay, and they chose accepting me, and so we never really had much drama about it again.
No, you were so lucky, especially since they were the parents who wanted you to change were the ones who put you into therapy. And to find a therapist who got it is kind of so lucky and amazing.
Yeah, you know, and I don't blame my parents about that at all. I mean, also, I was 15 and having an affair with a 22-year-old, which was not good.
Right.
When I have a child, and I would not allow that to happen either. So I sort of look back. Yeah, but I certainly I write about all that. And, you know, as we move to series, we have, a very moving storyline about a father who's coming to terms with the fact that his child is singing and is different, and he's a blue-collar guy. And a friend of mine who's a great actor named Mike O'Malley plays the father of the gay character who works at a tire shop and just cannot believe the fact that his son is dealing with skin care and astringents and singing. And that is, to a certain degree, based on my life. A little bit, but you know, the show is, that's a 1/10 of the show. The show, I think, is so much more consuming about every aspect of being young, not just that.
Now, in Glee, all the kids in it are in some ways losers. Like, everyone in
losers.
It is in some way a loser. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like when you were in high school, you were pretty popular and confident. So why do you relate to losers so much?
Well, because I was different, you know. And my friends were different. I had two groups of people. I had a group called The Clique. There were 8 of us. And then I had my other group of friends. And the group that we called The Clique were all the people who were like in drama club or honor society. And we were just different and unusual. And our dreams were bigger than where we were. And we wanted to get out. And that feeling I really understand. And that's the sort of the feeling that's in all those characters. That, you know, that their dreams are so big that their little heads almost can't contain them. That's what's moving to me, and I certainly draw on my experience when we're writing the show in that way.
Ryan Murphy, creator of the new Fox series Glee. He also created the WB teen comedy Popular and Nip Tuck, the FX series about cosmetic surgery. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from earlier this year with Ryan Murphy, creator of the new Fox musical comedy series Glee, about a high school glee club. The series premiered this week.
Now, you covered Hollywood for the Miami Herald?
A lot of places. Washington Post, Miami Herald, Daily News.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you covered Hollywood before actually becoming a part of it in the sense of like creating television shows. When you were just like covering it and you were writing about, you know, new shows and you know, the lives of famous actors and stuff, did you think, I really want to be a part of that? Or did you think, oh, I could do that or I could do better than that? Like, what was your relationship to Hollywood as a journalist? And did you want to get deeper into it?
I did. I mean, I always wanted to do that. I couldn't really afford to go to film school, even though I was accepted. But I always, in the back of my mind, thought, well, I'll get out there somehow. I don't know how. And how it happened was I was transferred to L.A., at a very young age. I was sort of like the L.A. bureau chief of the Miami Herald back when newspapers had money and could afford to do things like that. And I was going to start writing about news, but there's not a lot of news in L.A., so it became about celebrities and the business of Hollywood and all that stuff. And I had a syndicated column. And it never was that I wanted to be a part of it. I just at one point, I think what happened was I had interviewed Cher for the 5th time, and I was like, okay, you got to do something else. Even though I love her, I can't keep writing about her. We had a joke about it. And I went and I wrote a script, and at night when I was done working, I would stay up every night till like 3 in the morning writing, and I sold that script to Steven Spielberg, and that started my career. It just sort of happened. It was very sort of miraculous, and easy is the wrong word, because I guess that I had been preparing for that moment all along, but I literally just sort of wrote it, sold it, and fell into it and have never stopped working since. It was a great script that's never been made, but it's called Why Can't I Be Audrey Hepburn? that it was a big romantic comedy, and Spielberg particularly took a shine to it because he directed Audrey Hepburn in her last movie, which was Always. So he had a great relationship with her, and it was just about what she means as a metaphor in terms of romantic comedy to so many people. And it's sort of this paragon of style that so many girls of a particular age always aim to emulate.
So your parents were religious, they were church people. Did that make it harder for them when you came out?
Probably. Yeah. I think, you know, we were Catholic, and that was, the things you don't want to do when you're in a Catholic person is talk about abortion or gay rights. So, yeah, I think it probably was more difficult for them. And I went to Catholic school as well.
Oh, so how did you deal with Catholic school and with going to church? I mean, you had been in the church choir. Once you were out, like, could you stay in Catholic school?
I only went to Catholic school when I was in, first through eighth grade. But I was just a weird kid. I mean, I lived in a weird fantasy land. And I was obsessed with, movies and TV shows and books and anything to sort of get me out of there. And I got through Catholic school because I became obsessed with the idea that I could be the Pope. I was very.
You gotta be kidding.
I wanted to be the Pope. It was like, well, so in first grade, I announced to my family that I really wanted to be the Pope, and I was very confused about how do you be the Pope. And so my mother would tell me that you became the Pope by not committing any sins. So I would sort of begin my day every morning with a prayer: "Please don't let me sin." And of course, by the time I got off the bus, I would have committed three. And then I was like, "Well, this day's ruined. I'll start again tomorrow." But I would practice with my staff, and I had this outfit of robes. I would pretend to. I was really into it for very, very many years. And then slowly, it dawned on me that I would not be able to go through a day committing no sin. And chances were that I wasn't going to be the Pope, so I had to come up with another dream because I wasn't interested in just being a priest. I wanted to aim really, really high.
What?
But that was my childhood.
Outside of being like the top guy, why did you want to be Pope?
I was also obsessed with a book about the saints, and I thought it would be really cool to be the Pope because then you could decide who would get to be saints. And I was very interested in that process of sort of sitting people down or investigating them and figuring out what they had done made them worthy of that. I don't know. I was just very drawn to it. I think it's the same. There's no difference to me in my head about the little 6-year-old kid who was obsessed with the funny girl and who wanted to be the Pope. It's the same thing. You just wanted a way out. You wanted a way to express yourself and to sort of not stay in Indiana and be an insurance salesman or a farmer. And they both were so grand and bigger than life. I was just drawn to that. And I was actually encouraged by my friends and family to keep doing it. So I did. I was just a weird little kid. I liked weird little things.
So since you had at one point wanted to be Pope when you came out and you were kind of persona
non grata. Doesn't that sound ridiculous?
Well,
so you wanted to be the Pope, but I did.
Yeah,
it's
whatever,
sad.
You know. But so when you came out and making you kind of officially persona non grata in the Catholic Church, did it hurt to be rejected by the Church, or were you already done with the Church by then?
I was already kind of done with the Church at an early age, but I'm very, very glad that I had that religious upbringing because, it really taught me about storytelling and it really taught me about theatricality. I mean, the Easter services and the idea of people being raised from the dead and curing leprosy and the, Stations of the Cross and all that stuff I was very drawn to, and I realize now that I was probably drawn to it because it was just about a way to tell a story. And so I feel like I was very well served by that. And I still go to church, even though the church is not very embracing. As a whole, I think if you look at individual archdioceses, you see that, many of the priests and the nuns and the people who work at the church are. So I do go to church. I go to church, here in Los Angeles, and I've always been embraced in the church. The different kind of churches that I go to seem to have a sort of large gay contingency and no one says anything. So I just think that it's a different world than it was. I don't think anything is black or white anymore.
Now, as the creator of Glee, which is a musical and a music competition about music competitions, I have to ask you, if you could get up on stage now and sing any one song, what would you choose?
That's a good one. It would probably have to be Don't Rain on My Parade, because I remember that was the first movie I ever saw, and Funny Girl, and I practiced that one a lot with a kitchen spoon in front of the mirror. So I would probably give that one a try.
Well, I wish I could see it. Ryan Murphy, thanks so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Ryan Murphy speaking with Terry Gross in May when Glee was given an advanced sneak preview. The show premiered officially this week. Here's the version of Rehab that was performed in the pilot of Glee by a champion show choir. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Ohio, Ohio, Ohio. They're trying to make me go to rehab, and I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been back, but when I come back, you'll go, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they're trying to make me go to rehab.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On Monday, Jay Leno takes part in one of the most significant and potentially game-changing experiments in TV history. The former host of NBC's Tonight Show is taking his act to primetime on the same network in a comedy and talk show that gobbles up 5 key hours of TV time every week. If Leno succeeds, and other networks follow suit with low-cost programming instead of expensive dramas, broadcast television as we know it will be vastly different. If he fails, well, it's just the latest high-risk gamble by a veteran, hard-working comic whose memoir was called, quite fittingly, Leading with My Chin. Terry Gross spoke with Jay Leno in 1996 when his memoir was first published. He told her his childhood was different from those of many other comics.
Most comics that I've read about or met always seem to have these horrible childhoods, and the comedy come out of this horrible pain, which is legitimate, certainly. It just didn't work that way for me. For me, the humor was always the fact that my parents were in their 40s when I was born. And besides my mom being an immigrant from Scotland, my mom being Italian, the differences were so horrific.
Your dad being Italian?
Yeah, were just hilarious to me. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, in that sort of teenage rebellion thing. I remember I was in the eighth grade when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, I said, hey, Dad, the Beatles are going to be on. You know, my father, Beatles or whatever that is, you know. And so anyway, the Beatles come on and they're singing, yeah, yeah, whatever, doesn't want to hold your hand. And I see my dad with the newspaper in front of his face, you know, deliberately not watching, you know. And I just said to him, I said, you know, Dad, you know, the Beatles write all their own music. And my father just puts the paper down. He says, let me tell you something, you know, some manager gives these kids a couple of bucks to go out on a stage and act loony, and you kids all fall for it. And, you know, I couldn't even argue with that. It was so ridiculous. That was my father's whole explanation for the Beatles' career. Some guy gives them a couple of bucks, and they go out, and they act loony.
Do you remember your first laugh in front of an audience?
Yeah. This is sort of a story I've told a lot, but it's the first adult laugh. I remember always doing things. I remember the first thing I ever said that got attention. And I remember I couldn't have been more than maybe 4 or 5. But I remember I was over at one of my aunt's house, and my mom was there. And, you know, all the women were fussing around. There was some sort of get-together going on. In other words, just getting together for coffee or what it was. But it was like me and like 5 women, all my aunts and everything. And I remember saying to my mom, just making this observation. I said, Mom, why do girls have humps like camels? Well, of course, woo, 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 all the women, oh, my God, did you hear what the child said? Woo, I had no idea what I said. But I remember all the women, excuse me, running around, my mom going, oh, for goodness, and hustling me out of the room, and people laughing hysterically. And I'm thinking, what did I say? What did I say? They go, woo, woo, woo. You know, my aunt, you know, those kind of big women that would fan themselves when they heard something funny. Like this, you know, oh, the child should have heard me say, and I never got an answer to my question, but I just remembered that getting this tremendous reaction. I, And, you know, as a comic, I have a sort of a theory about comedians. They always remember everything that got a reaction. Any kind of reaction. Just it's like it makes an etch in your brain, you know? And that was the first thing that ever got a reaction. And then the second time I remember it happening was in the fourth grade. And it was a joke. I didn't think it was that funny a joke. But at the time, it was the first joke I think I ever said that sounded like an adult joke. It wasn't just a kid joke. We were in Miss Allen, who was still a great friend of mine. She was my fourth grade teacher. And she's still teaching now. I realize now that must have been like her first year. And she was teaching us about Robin Hood. And, you know, the Sheriff of Nottingham was very cruel. And I remember her saying that when the Sheriff of Nottingham would catch Robin's men, he would boil them in oil. I remember putting my hand up and I remember saying, well, he couldn't do that to Tuck. And she said, why? And I said, well, he was a friar, you know. Just a stupid joke. And it got kind of a laugh. And then I got scolded for it. But I remember later in the hall, I was walking down the hall and one of the other teachers said, hey, Jay, come here. What did you say in Miss Allen's class? What was the joke you told? I said, oh, they couldn't boil him and all. He was a friar. Oh, yes. And then another teacher asked me about it. And I said, geez, I like this. You know, this is great. This sort of feeling of influence. This is terrific. And it just always kind of stayed with me.
All he ever wanted was a little bit of attention.
Just a little bit of attention.
Was your humor ever considered a behavioral problem?
Yeah, as a kid, I was one of those hyperactive kids. And I was the classic, Jay has the ability, but does not apply himself. You know, if Jay spent as much time studying as he does trying to be funny, I mean, I still have that on my report card from Mr. Simon, my fifth grade teacher, that if I spent as much time studying as I do trying to be funny, I would be a big-time comedian or something like that. And, of course, I hear from Mr. Simon all the time now about, oh, how prophetic he was, and and it just kind of makes me laugh.
When you were starting in comedy, there uh-huh. weren't comedy clubs yet, not as we know them. Some of the venues that you played included retirement homes, prisons, mental hospitals. This is through a state program in Massachusetts where yeah. I think you got like $10
We used to get $10 a show to do old people's birthday parties for yeah. the state. We used to do prisons. I did a show at, like, Walpole State Prison. And prisoners are not a good audience. You know, because comedy is based on a certain civility. Hi, folks, how are you? You know, and when you got a guy sitting in the front row and he's got a little blonde kid on a choke chain wearing underpants sitting on the floor next to him, that's not an ideal audience, you know?
What material would you do in your
prison?
Just
do your regular act. I only had my act growing up, whatever. You know, I used to do these psychiatric homes and they get like, you know, and this is not to make fun of psychiatric patients, but, you know, you go there, hi, everybody, how you doing? And then, like, in the middle of your act, there'd be a guy in the corner going, ah! Ah! And then orderlies would come in. And because this would just break the mood of the whole room, you know. Say, anybody here from Boston? Ah! Ah! You know, hey, calm down there, fella. How you doing? You know.
Well, did this give you confidence performing in front of people?
Well, it was fascinating yeah. because you realized it wasn't until I performed at, like, this place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston that I ever got a professional audience. You know, I could always say in my own mind, well, you know, the audience, it's a psychiatric hospital. They didn't laugh because there's obviously something wrong with them.
Well, you can say, right, they don't laugh. You They're know, crazy.
Yeah, it was like strip clubs.
Yeah.
When I would play strip clubs, they wouldn't laugh or applaud or do anything. But it gave you the confidence just to stand on stage because the people weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I mean, there's a story in the book about playing this club called the Mineshaft where it was in Minnesota. People would pay $5 to get in. And then for another $5, the customers would get a miner's hat with a light on it. Now, there were no lights in the club. It was just a big, empty building. And the women would come out and dance. And, of course, the guys had the lights on their heads, and they would look at whatever part of the woman they wanted to look at with the light. And I would just be standing in the darkness, telling jokes. Hi, everybody. How you doing? Occasionally, somebody would look over at me, and I couldn't even look at them because they had the bright light on their head. So if they looked at me, ow, it burned my eye. I had to look away. So most of the time, for the whole week, I was just standing in darkness while guys looked at these women with those miner's hats on.
On your first shot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, mm-hmm. did he laugh at your jokes?
Yeah, he was very good, actually. He was a terrific audience. I mean, that's what The Tonight Show is. It's not trying to get the audience to laugh. It's trying to get Johnny to laugh.
Right.
But, you know, the audience gets the cue from the host.
Right.
And if Johnny is laughing, they're enjoying it more.
Did Johnny Carson give you advice about your stand-up act or later on about guest hosting or hosting when you took over?
Not so much about hosting, but he did about, the first time I did The Tonight Show. Well, actually, I was a guy that was sort of the last of my graduating class to do The Tonight Show. By graduating class, I mean all the guys I sort of started with, Robin Williams and, Letterman and guys like George Miller and so many of the comics. They all did it before me. And, you know, Johnny came in one night at the Improv to see me. Harvey Korman brought him in. And, there are two kind of comedians. There are comedians that have a lot of attitude and not many jokes. There are comedians that have a lot of jokes but not much stage persona. By attitude, I mean those kind of comics can get on stage and go, "Hey, pal, nice hat. All right, what did you win? Did somebody guess your weight?" You know, that kind of thing. And they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just funny in their nature, but there are no jokes. And then there are other comedians you take a guy like Stephen Wright, who are just natural joke writers. You know, very monotone. They tell the joke a certain way. And to me, the best comedians are the ones that combine both those elements. You have a joke and you have an attitude. I remember Johnny came to see me and he said, you know, he thought I was funny, but I wasn't ready for the show because my jokes were too far apart. You know, I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I listened. And then I started watching his monologue and I realized, you know, he was doing 15 or 20 jokes in a space where I was doing 5. I mean, I could get on stage and being sort of physically big and loud and imposing, I could get a laugh where there wasn't any. But that was great for a nightclub, but not for TV. You know, the idea being on television, if the joke doesn't work, your funny attitude will carry you through. And if your funny attitude doesn't carry you through, your joke will carry you through. And if they both work, you got a killer joke, you know?
You strike me as more secure, less insecure than a lot of comics.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty secure that way.
Less neurotic?
No, I'm not neurotic at all, actually. I'm not neurotic at all. I mean, Rich Lewis is a friend of mine, and he, you know, I watch him agonize. You know,
right.
He agonizes over every little thing. What's the joke? You like that joke. You know, Rich will say, "Here's a joke." He'll tell you the joke, and you go, "That's funny." "No, you didn't think it was funny." "It was funny." "Yeah, how funny was it?" "It was really funny." "No, it wasn't that funny. You're being polite." And this will go on for days. It'll go on for weeks if you let it. And, you know, I said to myself, "My God, where does that come from?"
So you don't understand neurosis?
Well, I mean, I understand it, and I'm lucky I don't necessarily suffer from it.
You're kind of famous for hating vacations, for not liking to not work. You like to work a lot. Is that still true, that you still don't like vacations?
I'm not a vacation guy. You know, I was somewhat dyslexic as a kid, and I always remember my mom saying to me, "Well, you're just going to have to work that much harder than the other kids to get the same thing." And when you brought up being insecure before, I never thought I was insecure. I just thought I was being lazy. And that may sound silly, but to me, if something didn't work, it didn't work because I wasn't working hard enough. Like when the whole thing with The Tonight Show was going on, is Jay going to be replaced? Is he going to get fired? They're going to replace him with Letterman. Well, obviously 16 hours a day is not enough. Maybe I need to do 18 hours a day. And it worked, you know. I mean, that's what works for me. You know, I never said I was the best. I never said I was the funniest. I just said I will work at this harder than anybody else. And that seems fair. I mean, that's sort of the American way, you know. I've always been a guy that worked on commission. Even when I was washing cars or had regular jobs, I was never a salary guy. I was always the kind of guy that would say, "Listen, why don't you pay me by whatever?" You know, when I took over The Tonight Show, when I used to go into bars with the $50. If you think it's good, pay me what you think it's worth. And eventually, do you get screwed at the beginning? Yeah, but everybody gets screwed at the beginning. You know, to this day, people say, "Oh, you're getting screwed." Really? I mean, I do very well. I've hosted The Tonight Show. I got the job I wanted. I mean, it's what works for me. And in my mind, if I'm one of those guys, like if I take a, you know, I went to Hawaii once. This was like a nightmare. I was doing a gig in Hawaii. And I had to stay down there like 3 days. And the second day, I'm sitting on the beach, and I look at my watch, 10 o'clock. I'm sitting on the beach about 4 hours, and I look at my watch, and it's 10:30. And I go, "Great, my watch broke. The battery's dead." And they asked them, "What time is it?" And they said, "It's 10:30. And I said, "Really? I've only been sitting here for half an hour? I thought it was like 2 o'clock. This is like a nightmare. Get me out of here." And, I'm not a vacation guy.
Jay Leno speaking to Terry Gross in 1996. On Monday, the Jay Leno show premieres on NBC in primetime 5 nights a week. A new documentary called No Impact Man follows a year in the life of writer Colin Bevan, who embarks on a radical lifestyle change and takes his family along. Bevan's book about his project is in bookstores now. It's subtitled The Adventures of a Guilty Liberal Who Attempts to Save the Planet and the Discoveries He Makes About Himself and Our Way of Life in the Process. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of the movie.
No Impact Man is an environmental documentary that also works as a 21st century climate change comedy of manners. Its protagonist, Colin Bevan, is the latest in a line of idealist heroes who are both admirable and somewhat ridiculous, an Albert Brooks sort of character. In 2006, the Manhattan writer came up with a book proposal. He would live for a year, quote, eco-effectively. That means, he said, having zero net impact on the environment. So he stopped driving or taking the subway and biked around the city. He ate only locally grown organic food. He bought no clothes. For the last 6 months, he turned off the electricity in his apartment, and he and his wife, Michelle Conlon, and their toddler, Isabella, lived in candlelight, trying to keep their food cold in an earthenware pot placed inside a larger pot, a device supposedly used with success in Nigeria, but not in Manhattan. He did do one thing high-tech. From an office outside the home, he wrote a blog, which a New York Times journalist read, which led to a mocking feature titled A Year Without Toilet Paper. Soon, Bevan was on with Stephen Colbert, and cameras from Good Morning America were there to film him throwing the switch that shut off his electricity. It must have been a tight squeeze in that dark apartment with documentary cameras filming TV cameras. No Impact Man centers on a flight from technology, but directors Laura Gabbert and Justin Shine set it firmly inside a media circus. Bevan's book, also called No Impact Man, and just out from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, is a different experience. His voice on the page is deeply earnest. He writes things like, I became excited about the possibility of breaking through our socially endemic isolation and connecting to our community and to some larger sense of purpose as a replacement for the material things we'd be giving up. But on screen, his wife Michelle makes a hilarious counterweight. Although it's not her project, she also has to live without lights or TV. She writes for, of all places, Business Week, and is an unapologetic materialist. Enduring withdrawal from her Starbucks coffee, she incinerates Bevan with a stare. When the family strolls through the local farmer's market, and Bevan remembers what else he needs, her face is a study in revulsion.
Oh, you know what? Are there worm people here?
What do you need the worms for? I don't know if I'm...
Can I tell you about it after?
Basically, the worms make it compost faster.
Honey, I'm not into that at all.
Okay, we can talk about it. Michelle!
Yeah?
Want to come see the worms? See them wiggling around in there, Mom?
Yeah. And then how do you make sure they don't get out?
They can't get out.
Wait, is there no cover?
Well, of course there's a cover, Lovie.
Oh. Let's cover it up.
What, Isabella's looking at them.
Okay, nature. Mom doesn't really like nature, but Dad likes nature.
If you see No Impact Man, you'll get a big close-up of that box of worms, and later, of the larvae that hatch and infest. You can only imagine Michelle's face then. There's a dramatic arc to the film, though, an opening out. Bevan sets off to report on the tons and tons of trash we generate. He interviews community gardeners, people who've attempted to be self-sufficient even in the urban jungle. And Michelle comes around. She tones up. She has an epiphany while working on an organic farm. She begins to feel more sure of this project, even as her husband is treated as a figure of fun, a limousine liberal. Bevan's book was trashed a few weeks ago by Elizabeth Kolker in The New Yorker as a stunt, although she admits that Thoreau's sojourn to Walden Pond was a stunt, too. She writes, the real work of saving the world goes beyond the sorts of action that No Impact Man is about. yes and no. Both the book and the movie focus on one man, but the film demonstrates his strong impact on the culture, thanks to media coverage, and by that, I include the film itself. That he's not perfect, that he's sometimes even a self-righteous jerk, makes him a less intimidating bearer of the movie's message, that our modern way of consumption has become unsustainable.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Today is the 8th anniversary of 9/11. 8 years ago, 10 days after that tragic event, Terry Gross spoke to poet Robert Haas, and we'd like to replay parts of their conversation today. Terry wanted to know, at that depressing and frightening time, if there were any poems Robert Haas was turning to. He was America's poet laureate from 1995 to 1997. He also translated poetry and edited the book Best American Poetry 2001. Terry called him at his home on September 21, 2001, and he told her he had spoken recently at a memorial service attended by 12,000 people at the University of California at Berkeley, where he teaches. Terry asked what he had said at that service.
You know, I think I said that we were a community of that took its meaning from teaching and learning, and it seemed like the lessons of the last week are ones that I don't know if they can be taught. The courage and resourcefulness of the policemen and the firemen and the ambulance drivers and doctors and nurses were one of the most powerful things about the weekend. I don't know if there's any way to teach people to respond that way. You know, one hopes that one would. That was one thing. And another was that way in which it just brought us up against the mystery of our lives, the way death does, you know, people going about their business. One friend of a friend described on the internet his being saved by, at the last minute, deciding not to go into a meeting because he passed a bakery two blocks away where he smelled cinnamon rolls, which he resisted the scent of. And then when he got to the World Trade Center and was about to go into the building, he thought, oh, what the hell, and turned around and wandered back toward the scent of cinnamon buns. When, you know, reads the stories about everybody, the person who just was phoning a wife and the person who was just starting to trade bonds and the person who was just booting up their computer, suddenly gone. So, finding a language for that. And I had just seen in the New Yorker a translation of a poem of Czesław Miłosz that I had done with him. This is a poem written when he was 89 that I thought spoke to this, this mystery of what, who we are, what our lives are. So I read that poem. It's called In a Parish.
Can you read it for us?
Sure. Were I not frail and half broken inside, I wouldn't be thinking of them who are, like me, half broken inside. I would not climb the cemetery hill by the church to get rid of my self-pity. Crazy Sophies, Michaels who lose every battle, self-destructive Agathas lie under crosses with their dates of birth and death. And who is going to express them, their mumblings, weepings, hopes, tears of humiliation, in hospital muck and the smell of urine, with their weak and contorted limbs and eternity close by? Improper, indecent, like a dollhouse crushed by wheels, like an elephant trampling a beetle, an ocean drowning an island. Our stupidity and childishness do nothing to fit us for the sobriety of last things. They had no time to grasp anything of their individual lives, any principium individuationis, nor do I grasp it, yet what can I do, enclosed all my life in a nutshell, trying in vain to become something completely different from what I was. Thus, we go down into the earth, my fellow parishioners, with the hope that the trumpet of judgment will call us by our names. Instead of eternity, greenness, and the movement of clouds, they rise then, thousands of Sophies, Michaels, Matthews, Marias, Agathas, Bartholomews, so that at last they know why and for what reason.
Robert Hass, reading the Czeslaw Milosz poem In a Parish, recorded in 2001, 10 days after 9/11. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley. We'll close with this recording by bassist Charlie Hayden.